Welcome to the sound of one man clapping. I am the one man coming to you direct from the bunker, living the dream and dreaming of living. True friggin' story. This is a podcast about board gaming culture, and growing old gracelessly. Something I tend to do with aplomb. Sharing with you today all the games that were. I'm going to talk about what's coming in with incoming! 4 exclamation marks. We'll hit the crowdfunding vibes with FOMO Mofo, and then we'll chat with the voices in my head before giving someone the clap. On with the show. This week in gaming for me, it was a great game for firsts. The Shelf of Firsts got a full fisting, and I got a few things off and loved every minute of it. I kicked off the week by playing a game I bought. I managed to find a copy on sale, I want to say about a year ago, maybe a little longer, and it was the deluxe version, and I can't remember why it was on sale, but it was a hell of a bargain, and that is Batman The Dark Knight Returns. Now, I am a mad DC fan, love Batman, love everything about Batman, and The Dark Knight Returns is a four-part, I wouldn't even call it a campaign, it's kind of a campaign, there's a very loose story that holds it all together, but it's a four-part solo game. And the rule book comes basically in four parts, book 1 to 4, and each one has a different setup and a different villain and some minor change to the rules. And it's a little Marvel United-esque, I guess, in the gameplay, with maybe just a tad much more going on. So really what you've got is you've got this board, and the whole board is a whiteboard, as in it's a dry erase board. It's not white. It's a dry erase board. You've got a dry erase marker because as you play, you're going to make changes to the board, including connecting areas with new paths. You're going to be locking areas off by scribbling them out. You're going to be making changes to the board, which involve changing your gameplay. And in The Dark Knight Returns, you've got basically 12 rounds. And you've got 12 rounds, which is 12 turns. And in a turn, you're going to flip an event card. That event card's going to give you some minor unique changes for the turn in question. You're going to make a move, and Batman can move quite freely. You know, he can swing from rooftop to rooftop, and there are some small limitations on that, but he really can move around a lot. It's not like move 1 or move 2. He can basically, he has unlimited move until he gets to a new sector, and then you're going to interact with that sector. And interacting with that sector might involve dealing with some bad guys, which are called mutants in the game. It might involve dealing with some cops who are good guys in the game, but they tend to get in your way because I'm Batman. And dealing with reporters who get in your way. And all three of these different factions, every space you go to is divided into thirds, like there's a little Mercedes symbol in the middle, and a faction blocks out one third of that space. And so if you deal with the faction in question and you can't deal with reporters, there's no way for Batman to deal with reporters, but you can deal with the mutants and cops. And once you deal with them, then you can have access to the space that's below, which might be clear off a reporter. You know, it's one way you can do it. You can't do it directly. Or it might be clear off another mutant. It might be increase your health. You've got three different stats that you have to manage through the game. You've got health, sanity, and I think it's might or something fisty. And this is a game of attrition. You start off with, you know, max stats. And when your stats hit the bottom, you're done. The game's over. And you've got to survive all four books to the very end to win the game. Look, it was really fun. It's not a lot of decision space in that, you know, you flip the event card over. You do have a hand of cards. There are three different kinds of cards. There's an event card, there's a fight card, and there's a detective card. And at the start of the game, you set up these decks. And if you're doing a fight, you can flip a fight card, and that fight card gives you access to a special defense or special attack. And then in your hand, you've got detective cards, which allow you to do detective-y type things. And it's a puzzle. It's really fun. It's not very heavy in that, you know, the decision space is, well, I've got to, because you're on the side of the board, you've also got three goals, and the goals might be clear out all the mutants in one part of town. And so, you know, well, I've got to do that. Spoiler here for anyone who's got this on their shelf of firsts and doesn't want to hear anything, maybe tune out for about 60 seconds. in book one, you're dealing with Two-Face, and Two-Face has clues all over the board. And once you flip those clues over, once you get enough clues, Two-Face manifests on the board, and then you fight Two-Face. And that book is over. Spoiler over, guys. For me, I looked at the 12 turns, and I wasn't 100% sure what that looked like from a game timer point of view. And so I was whizzing around to grab these clues, not realizing that the second you pummeled Two-Face that the round was over, meaning that my goals on the side of the board were left unachieved. I had a few things I would have liked to have done. And I think I was only on about turn 6 of the game out of the 12. And book one was done. So for me, I think I'd like to go back and replay book one. I think for me, I want to see what it looks like when you play it out, and maybe just sort of tickle out that final fight with Two-Face a little longer. You've got really cool dice in it. The dice are all batarangs, and they've got different symbols on the side. Combat's easy. You're rolling some dice for the bad guys. You're rolling some dice for Batman. You match them up. You roll again. And if you manage to eliminate some of the dice, then you're taking mutants off the board. Or cops, or whoever you're going against. It's really fun. If you love Batman, if you love something like a Marvel United, I think the decision space in Marvel United, particularly, you know, if you're playing solo two-handed, or if you're playing, you know, two of you together, you've got a little more space to say, well, here's how we might want to play this particular turn. In Batman The Dark Knight Returns, what you're going to do on your turn, once you've made a decision where you're going, it kind of sort of takes care of itself. You're rolling some dice and seeing what happens. So your main decision is really, which space am I going to? But it's fun. I love Batman. I had fun playing it. I'm going to reset it and start game one again and go back and do it again. I had not played it before as a first. I loved it, largely because I love Batman and I get to be Batman. The deluxe version comes with minis instead of standees, so I've got minis for Batman. You've also got in game one, you've got Commissioner Gordon as an ally. And Commissioner Gordon whizzes around the board, shooing away the media. So that's how you deal with the media, is every turn you get a chance to move Commissioner Gordon around and shoo the media away. There is a really interesting mechanic that I didn't see happen, largely because I think I finished game one too early, is that if all three spaces, all three of the subspaces on a location are filled with something, whether it's police or mutants or media or whatever the case is, then you have a riot in the space, and bad things happen when there's a riot. And Commissioner Gordon, one of the things he can do is he can help dispel riots. So looking forward to seeing more. As I said, love Batman. Really enjoyed the first one. This is by Daryl Andrews and Morgan Dauntonville, published by Cryptozoic Entertainment. Art by, who knows, they're not named anywhere in the credits. So it's DC-related art. It's kind of dark and mysterious. I suspect the art's taken from the comic because the game's based on a specific comic IP. So I suspect they haven't named specific artists because they've probably just ported the art over from the comic. So the second game I got to the table last week was SETI, The Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And if you're paying attention to that board game name, it is Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, The Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Which, as much as I think it's a very cool game, and there's a lot going on, and we're going to talk about that, it's like calling the game SETI SETI. And I'm sure somebody's raised that before. Ugh. SETI SETI. They could have just called it SETI. They could have just called it The Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. First world problems, minor niggle. But anyway, on to SETI. There's a lot been said about SETI in the last 6 months. Largely because most of the rest of the world got access to SETI last year around, I think it was released around Essen, so early October. SETI has just hit Australian shores. My copy delivered literally this week. And I've been dying to get to the table. So I put it on the table and I played a two-handed game because as much as I wanted to jump straight into the solo version, until you know the rules, the rhythm, and the pacing of something like SETI, I always prefer to play two-handed. And so what I would normally do, and this is what I do with Lacerda's or any chunky game that comes out, is I set up two players on the board. I play both players for a round or two until I get a meaningful feel for, well, this is how it feels. This is how the rhythm is. This is how the pacing is. And to be honest, I got so swept up in just the decision space, the board space, the whoa, what was that? I ended up playing a whole game two-handed, which is silly, right? Really silly. Like, it was an hour I could have spent doing something else that second half of the game. But it was so fun and so engaging. And I know there's a lot been said about SETI, so I'm not going to rehash everything there is about SETI. But I did tear it down with the intent of playing a solo game after that. And I took a break, popped upstairs from the bunker, and I was talking to my oldest daughter, Lou, and I said, look, I've just played this really wild game. I actually think you'd love it. And Lou doesn't play many games because she's 18 and, you know, she's got her own life. And like, dad, board games are, you know, whatevs. And she said, you know what? I'm in the mood. So she came down and we played SETI two-player. And it was fantastic. There are some things about SETI that I think probably aren't best at two-player, and I'll talk about those. But actually, Lou, who regularly will play Lacerda's because her brain's wired that way, came off of the SETI game and went, I think that's the best game I've ever played. She loved SETI, and she said, actually, I am really looking forward to playing that again. So if I can get Lou to the table and have her going, now she loves this, that supplanted Kanban. Kanban EV was her favorite game of all time previous to that. She absolutely loves Kanban. She thinks Kanban is a masterwork of gaming. And to be honest, if I thought I could get her to the table more often, I'd probably get my own copy of Kanban. As it is, I can borrow it from Super Trooper anytime. He's got Kanban Super Deluxe. But SETI was great. So the things I like about SETI. So if you've had no exposure to SETI yet, I'll give it a quick run through. In SETI, you are searching for alien life. There's a board in the middle that spins around. And so you've got the different layers of the solar system. You've got three different layers that actually move. So Earth's at the center, and the second layer has things like Venus and Mars, and the third layer has Jupiter and Saturn. And then the outer layer of the solar system doesn't spin, but you have things like comets and asteroid belts and whatnot. And you are, the purpose of the first half of the game, or the first part of the game, is you've got to launch probes. You've got to launch probes out, and they've got to go out into the solar system. And as you get those out, you're going to get certain things. You're going to get resources. You're going to get publicity, because the media is going to go, ooh, this company's out there. They've just gone to Venus. They're exploring Venus. You get publicity, and publicity is a resource you could spend. And then you have a choice in the latter part of those probes' journeys to either pop them into orbit around a planet, which gives you one set of resources, or you can land them on the planet for a different set of resources. And the landing on the planet gives you a resource. One of the resources you get on the planet is a piece of information about an alien species, and it's the only place to get them. So if you don't land on the planet, it's very difficult to unlock these alien species, because at the top of the board, you've got two alien species that come out of five. There are five included with the game, and I think SETI's ripe for an expansion that literally just gives you six more alien species. I think they could do that very easily. It's a small box expansion. Here's six more alien species. Go for gold. And that really, from a replay point of view, would just open this up. Not to say the replay isn't great. I think SETI's got a lot of replay. But you go to the planet, let's say you go to Venus, and you go into orbit, and you're going to get income boosts, you're going to get a resource, you're going to get a publicity, you're going to get some of those resources. And if you land on the planet, you get points, and you get one of these, you get a fragment of the alien information. And to unlock an alien species, you need a purple one, a blue one, and a yellow one. The only place to get yellow ones is on planets. You've got to land on planets. So, part two, you've got to scan the universe. So whichever way Earth is pointing, you can scan on your turn, and you go, ba-do, 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 and it goes out, and there's eight different sectors around, eight, six. There's six different sectors around Earth. I don't know. There's sectors. It's six or eight. I can't remember. And they're colored. There's yellow, blue, black ones. It must be six. Anyway, that part's irrelevant. And out in these sectors is data. There's a little pool of data out there. And depending on the strength of your scan and some other boosts that you can add to it, you're going to collect those data, you're going to put them on your player board, and you're going to swap those data out with a little token of your player color. And once all that data is done, those sectors get an area majority check, okay, which is really cool. So the sectors might need between 4 and 7 different data cubes mined off of those before the area majority check is done. And then whoever wins that area majority is going to get points, a couple of bonuses, and then you get the blue alien segment, which allows you to unlock the blue spot for an alien race. And then the purple ones, I tell a lie, that's how you unlock the purple segments of the alien race. And then the blue ones, on your player board, you have this track that you're filling with data. As you get these little data bits from scanning the solar system, you're filling this track up with data, which has all kinds of combo stuff in it. There's modules you could slot into there for bonuses. You have ways to increase your income and publicity along there. But if you fill that all the way to the end, then one of the actions you can take is to mine your own data, basically. And you wipe that out and you get the blue segment. Now, once an alien race has the blue, the purple, and the yellow one filled in by whoever's done it, the little alien board flips over and you have a whole new mechanic added to the game. And that mechanic is very loosely thematic, is Euro of the Euro of the Euro, but you've got more placement spaces that open up, and you've got a card, a deck of cards that add to the cards you can now get. And we haven't talked about cards yet. And so then you unlock the alien species, and really cool stuff happens. There's a very, each alien species has a very loose theming about how they interplay and what they're about, but really it's just a, it's another Euro space, another Euro section that opens up. And to be honest, there's five rounds in SETI. I found in the two plays that I did that by the end of round two, both of those were opened up. So it wasn't really something that you're looking at, oh God, it's round five before we've unlocked the two alien species. That's really boring. I've only played two games, but in both of them, I think they were both unlocked by the end of round two, which is fantastic. And all of a sudden, your decision space gets wider, which is wonderful because now the alien fragments you're getting, the yellow, the blue, and the purple ones, they get cashed in for different bennies, different benefits that the alien species are able to provide, whatever that species is. And so you're still getting those little alien fragments by scanning, by landing on planets, by analyzing your own data. But now they give you, rather than adding in towards the unlock of the species, they give you specific benefits from that species, which can be points, they can be more cards from the alien species, they can be... One of them has this really cool mechanic in that you get these cards, and then when you play the card, on the score track, you've got to put a marker 15 spaces ahead where you are. And when you cross that, you get the huzzah benefit from the card itself. And thematically, that's because this particular species is 7 trillion light years away and there's a delay. So you're sending off a, hey, this would be really cool if you could share this with us. And it takes so long for that to go out and come back. And then you get that benefit on a delay. Really clever, really cool, really interesting. The part I really love about SETI is the card play. Now, there is an Arc Nova stack of cards. I played two full games, and we didn't go through all the cards. So I played a two-handed game, and then I put those to one side. In the game with Lou, we played with more cards. And at the end of that game, there were still about 30 or 40 cards we hadn't touched. So there are gazillions of cards. And each one of them has a unique piece of art, a unique little bit of flavor text down the bottom. And in most cases that I could see, it's something factual. So it might be about the SETI telescope in Parkes in Australia. It could be about, I don't know, I was so so enamored with the gameplay, I wasn't doing flavor text. But these cards are multi-use in a massive way. So the card can, you can simply cash that card, you throw that card down, in the top left there's a free action or a free resource. And that resource is usually either a publicity, an extra move for one of your satellites. There's three or four different resources. You throw that down and you cash it in. You spend the card as a free action. It doesn't count as one of your turn actions. And you get to do that little tiny action on the top of the card. The top of the right card is a colored sector. It's red, yellow, blue, whatever it is, black for the sectors. That's right, red, yellow, blue, black. So there are eight sectors. And when you scan, you choose the scan action. You can burn one of your cards and you get an extra scan in the colored sector that matches the card. Now, this is wonderful for two reasons. One, it advances your presence in the scan sectors and puts more data on your board. But if you're pointing at a yellow sector and you take the scan action, it goes out from Earth and you're scanning that sector. If you're playing a card with a sector you're not pointing at, it allows you to scan for a sector that might be totally behind Earth, which is a couple of rotations away from actually pointing at it. And, you know, I guess ostensibly that counts as maybe, well, we're bouncing that around Earth on satellites to scan the other way. Whatever. But it allows you to, I guess, advance your scanning in the sectors in a way that you can either double up on the one you're pointing at because you like that one, or you can scan in a completely opposite direction. Let's say you're almost ready to complete a sector. And one more scan will do it, and it's behind Earth. You can play that card, it completes that sector, and then after your turn, you do the area majority and blah, blah, blah. Then the card itself has a cost value on it that you pay in money. And money is so hard to get in this game. Oh my God, it's so tight. It makes Everdell look loose. And so you pay money, you play the card, and then that card will have an action on it. And there are only six or seven different actions, but the cards have clusters of actions built on them. So an expensive card might have two or three clustered actions on there that might work well together, they might not, or they might have a double up of the action, so it might be scanned twice, or so you've got the card play itself. And then the cards will also often have a section in them for either a goal you need to achieve. So the goal might be have 3 satellites on Jupiter. And when you do that, you flip the card over and it counts as an endgame goal. And the more goals you have at the end of the game, some other achievements will say, well, you get 5 points for every goal you achieve. And then the cards could also have a gold band in them, gold, not gold, G-O-L-D. And it will say, for every satellite you have in or around Saturn, you get 3 points. So these cards give you a myriad of ways to use them, you know, and you go to hand of cards, and also getting cards is also, it's not like you get one card at the end of every round automatically, and the rest you have to either farm or get in other ways. The decision space is delightful. The box is super, so the game is super sandboxy. You can be like, well, I'm going to go down the scanning route, because on your player board, you've got 3 different areas that you can advance your technologies in. One is your probe management, one is your scanning, and one is your data collection. And you can't do it all, because getting a technology is really expensive. So you've got to sort of look at the board state and go, well, and your cards in hand, and say, well, this is the direction I'm going to go in at this point. And so you might invest in a technology for scanning because you've got some great scanning cards or some great scanning abilities, or Earth is pointed in a great spot for scanning. Or you might decide, well, I'm going to invest technologies in my probe techs because Earth pointed at Neptune. And if I can plant a probe on Neptune's moon, that's 26 points just for dropping that. Now, Neptune's way out there, right? So that's, you got to play a long game. You got to get a probe out. You've got to spend a lot of moves to get it out there. And you've got to invest in the technology that allows you to land on moons. Once you do, 26 points is a lot. It's a lot. But if you can land on the moon, it is a big chunk of points. But you will be doing that at the cost of other things. I think SETI is a delight. The only hesitation I have is I think the scanning mechanic is underpowered. And I think if you play a scanning game and everyone else at the table is playing a probe game, I think you're going to be outmaneuvered. I really do. I think that the area majority, if you start getting area majority in a place, then the incentive, like if you get an early lead in one of the scanning sectors, the incentive for other players to then get in there and invest there is pretty low, because the benefits for being second, while there are some, they're not fantastic. Other than you get those data cubes, which allow you to mine your own data on your board, right? So there is an incentive there. And if you don't scan at all, then you're going to have a hard time. Like, I've only played 2 games. I'm going to play a couple of solo games in the coming week, I think. I'm going to reset it up before I head back to work. It's a public holiday here in Australia today. So I think I'm going to set it up for some solo runs, because now that I know the game movements and mechanics inside out, I can tackle the solo and maybe get a solo game in before this coming weekend, or 2 or 3 really, because it plays pretty quickly. We'll see. And I might just take one of those games and play a pure scan game and see how it comes across. But anyway, SETI, great game. It's only just been released on Australia's shores. I got my copy last week. Spoiler alert for incoming. Enjoyed SETI immensely. SETI is by Thomas Holick. There are 11 artists in the credits. I'm not going to sit here and make you listen to me read artist credits for the next 4 minutes, but there are 11 artists, and the art in SETI is excellent, and it's published by Czech Games. This last week, I got a game to the table. This was not a first. This was not off my shelf at first, but this is a game I love, and I had not gotten it to the table in well over a year. And it was part of, if you listened to the bonus episode last year with Super Trooper, this was part of my tabletop aspirations for 2025, which is games that I absolutely was determined to return to the table. And it's a solo-only game, and that's Nemo's War, the Ultimate Edition. Now, Nemo's War, it's a war game, make no mistake. But what's interesting about Nemo's War, and let me not bury the lead, Nemo's War is amazing. I absolutely adore Nemo's War, despite the fact that to date, I have never won a game of Nemo's War. It's a bit like Robinson Crusoe and I guess Frostpunk in that sort of way. And I know you can win Nemo's War. I'm just not very good at Nemo's War. But in a game of Nemo's War, you have actually 8 different, I guess, mandates you can choose at the start of the game for Nemo, whether he's a pirate, whether you're choosing a war mandate, whether you're choosing an explorer mandate, and there are different things you need to manage. So, for example, there's on the track, there's an aspect called notoriety. And if you're playing the explorer mode on notoriety, your game's over if your notoriety hits like 35, for example. It's done because you're too infamous, you've been too dangerous, you're an explorer, you're not meant to be strolling around, you know, smashing boats and whatever the case is. Whereas if you're playing the pirate, well, your notoriety could be maxed out at 50. And it's not that no one cares, but it's not going to end your game. You're a pirate, right? And you're going around and you're absolutely blowing everything out of the water and having a great time and pillaging and searching for treasure, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Nemo's War is, I would say the barrier to entry with Nemo's War, unfortunately, is quite high because it's an unusual game to learn in that it's not complicated. In Nemo's War, you're going to flip a card from the event deck. There's probably going to be some kind of test on that card, and the test is a die roll. You're rolling dice, two dice, and it'll be test eight. You've got to get eight or higher. And you have different things you can spend to add device roll modifiers, right? And that's easy. So you do that, you roll your dice. If you fail, there's often some kind of perilous consequence. You lose one of your key resources. Your key resources are Nemo, crew, and hull. And if any one of them gets to zero, you're done. There's no money in Nemo's War. It's really just your three key ship resources and your treasure hoard of whatever you're collecting. And treasures can be endgame points. Treasures, sometimes you pull a treasure and it'll say you can spend this treasure for a reroll, which is really cool, or you can keep it for 3 points. So you've got that agonizing, well, am I going to keep this for 3 points or am I going to spend it? You've also got, I think, six crew members. And each of the crew members has a one-time use. So it might be extra action points. It might be a reroll. It might be a +3 device roll modifier. But you use it once, and then that crew member dies. And that crew member has endgame points. So if they're alive at the end of the game, you get points. If they're dead, you get none. So you have all these really tight, meaningful decisions every single turn. But you're going to flip a card. You're going to do the test that's on it. Pass or fail. If it's pass, it goes in your pass pile, which will contribute points at the end of the game, depending on the icons of the card. If it fails, it goes in the fail. And usually something bad happens. Your notoriety can go up or you lose resources. And then you're going to roll dice for placement. So at the start of the game, you're rolling two dice. If you roll a 2 and a 6, you're going to put new ships out at space 2 and space 6. There are 6 numbered spaces, and there's 5 overflow spaces in between them. And they're all the different oceans on the map. Art by Ian O'Toole, by the way. Amazing, amazing, amazing. And the iconography and the on the board, everything you possibly would be doing on the is on the board. So when you're taking a test, it tells you how all the modifiers work and what the pass fails are. And if you're everything about the game, once you learn it, is on the board, which is amazing. And all of that's fantastic. But I think the barrier to entry lies in the fact that the rule books, while really well written, are split in half. There are two totally different rule books. And until you've had a chance to get your head around Nemo's War and refer to them once or twice and really learn the game, you kind of can't keep straight in your head which of the rule books you need to go to. So you go to one rule book and you get to a passage and it'll say, well, you actually need to look in the other rule book for this. And I think that in and of itself presents a barrier to entry that is not insurmountable, but means that Nemo's War is for a niche group of gamers. Anyway, back to the gameplay. So you're going to place new ships out, and they escalate. As you get through the game and you move through your event deck, there are a number of cards in there that will escalate the game, putting in stronger ships into your draw bag. You've got a draw bag, you pull the ships out, you throw them on the board. So the ships go out, and then, depending on what you've rolled, so if you roll a 2 and a 6, you put a ship out at 2 and a 6, and you get the difference between those in action points. So that's 4 action points. And so to move to a new ocean is 1 action point. To initiate a combat is 1 action point. To repair your ship is 2 action points. To rest your crew is 2 action points. There is no way in the game, unless you draw a card that does so as a test, to refresh Nemo. So Nemo goes down as the game goes on. If he gets to the bottom, you're done. There are a number of cards that will do so, but there's no core action that refreshes Nemo. However, there are core actions that will repair your hull, rest your crew, for example, which is great. And then you're going to sail around and make decisions. You also have an option to refit. So you draw 4 random technologies at the start of the game, and you can pay a resource in salvaged ships. So if you destroy a ship, it goes into your sunk to the bottom of the ocean, which gives you points at the end of the game, or you collect the parts for salvage and they can be spent on new technologies which upgrade the Nautilus, which is great. You need those upgrades to win. Not that I've ever won. Nemo's War is awesome. The rhythm and flow of the game is fantastic. Because it's one player, you're not taking a turn and then dealing with bot stuff. It's made for one person. It's a one-person game. They have a two-player variant where you kind of share the decision space. That's insane because Nemo's War is a single-player game. And I get why they did it, because there are probably some people like, well, I'd like to play this with my girlfriend, my wife, or my brother, or my best friend, whatever the case is. I can't think that Nemo's War would be improved in any way, shape, or form by having to unpick this decision with two people. Nemo's War, the flow is fantastic. You draw a card, you take your turn. You draw a card, you take your turn. And then there's this horrible mechanic, which is wonderful at the same time, that if you roll doubles, so remember your action points are the difference between your dice. If you're rolling doubles at the start of your turn, and if you're rolling a dice at the start of your turn, you roll doubles, you get zero action points. You roll double fives, 5 minus 5 is 0. So other things happen. It's called a lull turn. And, you know, it represents currents fighting against you, whatever the case is thematically, but you can't do anything, with the exception that you have the option to save one action point from turn to turn. And so sometimes you really need that action point in a turn, and sometimes you think, well, I'm going to save that in case I roll doubles. So if you roll doubles, you get no action points for that turn. Other benefits happen, treasures spawn on the board, and other things happen, but if you haven't saved any points or you don't have any other ways to farm action points, because there are some, one of your crew can be flipped for action points, some treasures can be cashed in for action points. If you don't have those, you're stuck. And so you're spawning new ships and you can't do anything on your turn. I played 3 games back to back last week. I set it up, had to do a bit of a relearn because I hadn't played Nemo's War in ages, and it was so good. I literally played 3 games back to back over 2 days. I only made it to the end of 2 of those games, so you can, your game's over if you lose any one of your resources, or if you're playing one of the factions where your notoriety bombs you out with defeat before you get to the end. I made it to the end of 2 games, as in I was still alive, but when you counted the points up, it was, you're a loser. But you know what? So much fun. Nemo's War, I've ticked it off for Token Aspirations for 2025. I will absolutely bring it out again in 3 months probably and do another big burn of 2 or 3 games back to back because it is fantastic. And then, last game of last week, I played a game off my shelf of firsts that I bought at PAX last year. It's a game that I have been really dying to play. And yesterday was Sunday and I was finishing off Nemo's War and the Peanut said, hey, when you finish that, can we play a game together? And I went, heck yes, we can. Absolutely. So she went away and did whatever she was doing for another bit. And she came back about an hour later and I had set up Flock Together. So Flock Together was a Kickstarter that came out, I think it released last year. It's a 2024 and I think it hit Kickstarter a year before that. And Flock Together is a co-op game where you play chickens. It's kind of like a very mini toned-down chicken RPG. And you're on the farm, and you have 4 predators that are at different spots around the farm. And you've got to survive together to the end of the game and eliminate all 4 predators. And the production in Flock Together is fantastic. There's only one version. Right, so if you're going to buy Flock Together, know that you're getting the deluxe version because there's only one version. It's deluxe or get a different game. And I actually really love that about this game. And I managed to pick up a copy of this at PAX last year from a company that was selling copies that they'd bought as part of the Kickstarter and brought it home and had a look at it and punched it and sorted it last year and put it away. And I thought, oh, well, that looks interesting. So yesterday I set it up and the Peanut came in and went, Flock Together? Heck yeah. Why have you set 3 places? I said, because we're going to wrestle Mummy to the table and make Mummy play. Because the fox was doing something else. And so we set it all up. I watched the video. And the video teaches 17 minutes. It's an excellent, short, sharp video. You can learn Flock Together in a 17-minute video. It was fantastic. And at the end of the game, I knew exactly how to play. Because it's not overly complicated, Flock Together. And so in Flock Together, you start the day, you've got a little spiral-bound book that has your chicken of choice in it, and there's basically 3 pages in it. Page 1 is when it's a chick, page 2 is when it's a pullet or a cockerel, it's a teenager, and page 3 is full-grown. and you grow your chicken by contributing some of the food that you've got to the growth of your chicken. And you've got a track, and when it hits certain thresholds, it's going to grow. And as your chicken grows, it's going to get more health, which makes sense. It's also going to get access to a new standard power. So at level one, the standard starting is not so much a power as it's usually, well, you start with an egg or you start with a couple of food. And then at level two, it might be you can dodge one predator retaliation. And at stage three, they're not really extravagant powers. They're really easy for the peanut to grok. So we played. And on your turn, start of your turn, you're going to flip a new weather card. There's three seasons you go through, spring, summer, and autumn. If you get to the end of autumn and the final boss is not defeated, you lose the game. If all three chickens die, you lose the game. If you defeat the final boss and we're not all standing in the field together, we lose the game. So everybody wins or everybody loses. And it's a delight. So on your turn, you're going to get a production. As a chick, that production is a food. As you grow, that production is eggs. Because eggs can be used for a couple of different things. So you're going to get eggs rather than food once you grow up. And that makes sense. Chicks can't lay eggs. And then so you're going to do your production. You're going to flip a new weather card. And that weather card adds a layer of, for this round, this is the determination. This is an extra thing you've got to consider. So for example, you flip a weather card and it's a hailstorm. And that is, if you end your turn outside, you're going to take one damage. So that means that whatever you're doing, by the end of your turn, you've got to be in the chicken coop. And you might go, well, I want to do something else with my turn. Because your turn is two actions. So for your turn, you can forage to get food. You can eat your food, which depending on whether you're standing in the coop, if you're standing in the coop, it's going to heal you. If you're out in the field, you're going to grow. You can fight. You spend food to fight. There's eight actions. They're really simple. They're all laid out on your player board, which is fantastically laid out. Very easy to understand. And then the weather comes out, and then you get two actions. Two actions, and then it moves on to the next person. Once everyone has taken their two actions at the table, you advance to the next day, you flip a new weather card, and you do it again. So there are essentially 21 rounds in the game, and it's done. There are four predators on the board, and each of them have their own spiral-bound book. And if every one of them that's still alive, when you move to a season, it grows. So they start off, you know, we were fighting Hens Gruber. Hens Gruber was a raccoon. And Hens Gruber was a raccoon. And every time you punch him, he not only hits you back, but you roll a die. And depending on the die roll, he steals some of your food because raccoons are turd buckets. If Hens Gruber is still alive when we go from spring to summer, he's getting stronger. So you flip the page in his book and he gets bigger. The nice thing is the hits you've done in each season, they stay and accumulate, but he does get stronger, just like the chickens as we're growing. So then you've got to deal with Hens Gruber at level two. So the sooner you knock these guys out, the better it is for you. I loved Flock Together. The peanut loved Flock Together. The fox, spoiler alert, loved Flock Together. And what I was most impressed with, I think, is that it was an hour and a half. It was a 90-minute game. The peanut's 9 years old. Holding her attention at the table for an hour and a half is amazing because she'll play something for 30 or 40 minutes if it's super engaging. Like she'll play Raccoon Tycoon. She tends to tap out sort of towards the end because it's not got enough to hold her. The art in Flock Together is done by Andrew Bosley, and the art is spectacular. The art on these chickens as they grow, on these predators as they grow, the art on the board, the art on the cards, the art on your player board, and the iconography, it's amazing. And so I think for the peanut, it was watching us get around the board and take on these predators and watching their damage grow. And we get to that final boss, and we lost. We lost the game. The boss had 3 hit points left, and we had no turns left, and the season ended. We lost. But you know what? What was amazing is there was no disappointment at the table because that journey of us working together and working out what are we going to do? And by the end of it, the peanut was looking at her board going, okay. So I can move out there and spend this food to grow, or I can move to the coop and I've got these 3 food I've saved up. She worked out early on that she could, you know, lay a ton of eggs. And then, because there's certain times in the season where you can cash eggs in for food, and she had this food bonanza, and she was using that food in huge... It was so great. It was so great. It's age 10 and up to play. The peanut's 9. She turns 10 in May. We loved it. I immediately hopped on and late pledged for the expansion because the expansion is more chickens, more villains, more weather cards. And I actually can see Flock Together being something we get to the table pretty regularly. High five, guys. And I want to say, you know, Flock Together is done by Matt Mundy, art by Andrew Bosley, published by Sea Cow Games. I believe Sea Cow Games is Matt Mundy's company. This is their first game. And I hopped online and I just posted. I said, man, that was just so much fun. And Matt Mundy hopped on and said, I'm glad you enjoyed it. We swapped a couple messages back and forth. He's clearly very passionate about this. And I think for a first game, well done. It's not Pandemic Legacy. It's not Mage Knight. But you know what? We are going to play the bejesus out of this game in this house. And I can't wait for more. Flock Together. Boxes on the doorstep, new delights inside. Heaven's on fire, fields to divide. Now on for incoming! Four exclamation marks, spoiler alert. SETI, that is all. SETI came in last week, played it twice. I'm going to play it more this week. As I mentioned last week, we are not talking about that game, the one that I've mentioned once or twice, the game that shall not be named until it graceth my front porch. A whole bunch of other stuff is imminent. Tabriz is on the way sometime. That's the Persian carpet weaving game by Randy Flynn. Pandora's Box for Hoplomachus Victorum should be here literally any day. I haven't got a shipping notification, but it's coming. I just got a message from Ion Games that PAX Hispanica is on its way. That is the PAX game based in the Caribbean. It's got pirates and other fun stuff. And I pre-ordered that in January 2023. And that's, I believe, by Phil Eklund. So I'm really looking forward to seeing that one come. And that's it. Incoming is incoming. That's, yeah. Everything's going to come all at once. You watch. All of this is going to dump on the front porch. Postman Pete's going to have to make 9 trips from the van and then check himself in for rehab. This week on FOMO Mofo, a couple of updates, a couple of commentaries here. The first I want to talk about is the Everdell Silverfrost campaign, which I talked about last week. I was in for a dollar on this, and I think I spent a bit of time going down the rabbit hole with this campaign and I guess unpicking it a little bit. And I love Everdell. I think it's a great game. I really like Farshore. But the campaign itself, it's a little weird. You know, and I'm not sure whether they've changed marketing managers or whether they're just going, well, it's Everdell, we don't have to work too hard. But for one, there's no content attached to it at all. There's no videos of play, there's nothing, you know, and it's not like I need to see another play by Rado or another, but I'd like to see it on the table and really see it in motion. There's a rule book, you can go read the rule book, but, you know, it doesn't really give you a feel for the rhythm of the game itself. Everything on the page seems to be a render. There doesn't seem to be any practical components. There's no photographs. There's really no substance to the campaign at all. I have no doubt the game will fulfill. You know, this is Tabletop Tycoon. They make a lot of games. They've made millions off Everdell. I think the campaign's getting close to $1 million all on its own. $1 million Australian anyway, all on its own. So I don't think there's any risk attached to it. I just am, you know, going to sit back and hold on at this point. It was only a dollar, but at the same time, I don't think I'm going to go in for this because if I want to play Everdell, I'll play Everdell. And if I want to play something that's Everdell adjacent, I'll play Farshore. If it comes out next year and the reviews are, wow, this is now the definitive Everdell-esque game, well, then I'll look at it. But for me, it kind of smells like, well, we're Everdell, so this is what we're going to do, and we're just going to put it up there. But maybe not. Whatever. So, Everdell Silverfrost, by the time this publishes tonight, this episode, I think it's only got a day or two left, but I've removed my dollar because I think I'm going to save my money for other spaces. The other one that I'm watching closely, the Pest expansion pledge manager is opened for late pledge, and the pledge manager is opened. Now, I have Pest. It's sitting on my shelf at first. It's literally still in shrink. Pest was a really interesting one from Arcona Games. And Arcona, if you're following what they kind of do, they're really the kind of company that crowdfunding was made for. They don't really go to retail unless retailers have backed their games. They make interesting, different games. The other one they've got live right now is a game called Philharmonics, which is like space orchestra. They've got interesting concept. It's interesting. Pest looks interesting. It's just one that's sitting on my shelf first, and I haven't played yet. And the expansion adds not just some new content, but some new quality of life stuff. The Capital City miniature that came out with the original, which is a kind of an interlocking plastic centerpiece, it wasn't well made. It got a lot of slaughter in social media. And to Arcona's credit, they've said, look, if you're backing anything in this, you can have the fix kit for this for $1. Or is it free? I think they've said you can have it for $1 and you pay shipping, or you can have it for free as an add-on to anything else you're buying, which I think is really noble. So their fix kit has a new mini for the middle, which is not small. It's like a 5-part plastic mini. It fixes some cubes that were a funny color, some player cubes, and it has some balancing aspects in some of the card decks. And I think they're charging $1 plus shipping if you want it, and guarantee that costs them well more than $1. Or if you back the expansion, it's free. It's not that I think Pest needs an expansion, because I've never played it, but because I guess I feel this, I feel a social responsibility, at least sometimes, in between backing Awakened Realms and Seamon monstrosities, to throw my money at the little guys and keep them going. So I was in for $1 in the main campaign, because when Pest came out, it was a timing when I didn't have a lot of money in my board game account. The Pledge Manager, I think, is going to be open until September or something, and it's meant to fill later this year. So yeah, I'll be in for the Pest expansion. The expansion also comes with a big box to hold it all. It's got playmats. Not that I need a playmat, but I've done the math, and getting everything new is significantly cheaper than just getting the bits I want. So yeah, that's coming. The big box looks like it's not going to fit in a Kallax, which will piss me off for the next 20 years. But whatever. Pest, companies like Arcona. Guys, you know, if you've got a little money in your account, they're the kind of guys that I think we should be looking to take care of. You know, even if you, the games, don't buy a game, it's not for you. But crowdfunding can't just be for the Mind Clashes and the Awakened Realmses. You know, it's got to be something that, for me personally, I love this hobby, and if we got to a time when companies like Arcona went under because they weren't getting enough, that would be very sad. There are many, many imminent launches for a myriad of great products. This is going to be a tough year for my board gaming account, not just for new projects that are launching up and coming in the next, as early as next week, but over the coming sort of 4 to 9 or 10 weeks. There are a myriad of beautiful projects that are coming, both from big, medium, and small publishers. And a ton of pledge managers for stuff that was around Christmas time last year will be opening. So stand by, watch this space. FOMO Mofo is going to get hot and dirty this year. I can feel it. This week in Voices in My Head, I want to talk about the joy and sometimes deep, deep pain of game inserts. You know, and I guess I'll preface all this by saying, yeah, first world problems, right? Like, if you can afford an insert at all, you're doing well, because if you buy an insert, it usually means you're diverting money from board games or other things in your life. I love an insert. I love a good insert, right? And so, being a regular backer of crowdfunding, so many crowdfunding games, they come with inserts. They come already. You know, it's part of the campaign. It's part of the draw. Certainly Awakened Realms does that. You know, Awakened Realms and Seamon, they're really big on inserts. Awakened Realms tends to do quite good inserts. Seamon, sometimes not so much. But anything that helps organize the inside box potentially is a good thing, right? Maybe not. But games I have like Voidfall, the game trays for Voidfall are spectacular. And it's also, if you play Voidfall more than once every 10 months, it's very easy to remember how it goes back together. It all goes in this gargantuan, I've got the Galactic box, it all goes in this gargantuan box, no lid lift, it's beautiful. Wonderland's War, another example of a great, great insert. Again, you've got Castles of Burgundy, the special edition. I'd call that insert mid-tier, because its functionality is fine, but I think it was made more specifically for the non-deluxe version. The deluxe version fits with a few, I guess, left of center adjustments. And the quality of the plastic isn't so great. But I get everything's a decision for these guys, right? You do higher quality plastic, then obviously you've got to charge more for the game. games that do amazing inserts off the shelf. You know, anything from Eagle Griffin, really. Anything from Eagle Griffin that I've experienced anyway has an outstanding insert. And certainly when you look back at some of their stuff of sort of 8-10 years ago, like On Mars and Kanban and whatever else, their inserts were fine. But certainly as you've moved forward with newer versions, and I'm talking more about Lacerda's because that's what I tend to buy from Eagle Griffin, like Weather Machine and Inventions, the inserts are even better, such that they've color-coded some spaces of them. The insert comes out and it comes into segments, so handing out player pieces is a dream, which I know from memory, the On Mars and Kanban ones, it's like one big sheet of receptacles, and you kind of have to park that on the table, and it's fine. It's fine for storing the game. It's not great for playing the game. And then you've got games like Sky Mines and Civolution, which include tuck boxes. Sky Mines tuck boxes, well, they're okay. It's literally just 6 boxes that you dump stuff in, and they fit in the box. And the boxes are, you know, you've got your player boxes and your other components, and but it really is just boxes you're dumping stuff in. The Civolution tuck boxes are great. They, you know, in fact, the card box has high quality dividers in it that allow you to see everything. And so I by and large really love it when a company includes an insert. Some of them are not. I don't own tons and tons of Garfield games. You know, I really only own the South Tigris collection. I own all 3 of those. The first 2 came with an insert. And to be honest, those inserts are a hate crime. They literally make the game harder to set up, because just even trying to get your fingers in the areas and get these tiny little pieces out is a nightmare. I just can't bring myself to baggy it and chuck it, unfortunately. And the third iteration of that series, Garfield's just going to stuff it. Here's bags. It's just gone. We're not going to try. And I think partly that's because Inventions of the South Tigers has so many parts in it. If you bag it, everything's just packed to the top. So, game inserts. River of Gold's another recent offender. River of Gold is on my shelf at first. It arrived. It's a beautiful looking game. Beautiful box, beautiful board. And the insert's beautiful. The insert's metallic gold. It has almost zero functionality for storing the game. You try and put the game parts in that insert and you run out of insert immediately, and you're left with bagging extra stuff and stuffing it on top. So it's kind of like, I get you wanted to do something that was thematic for your game, but you've wasted money for you, you've wasted money for us. Either put an insert in there that's functional, or just don't bother, guys. Anyway, so, well, the other thing that drives me nuts is games that include an insert, and even sometimes a really functional insert, but no clue, no hint, no diagram on where things are meant to freaking go. Like, honestly, like, you get an insert, and it's in there, and there's all these spaces, but you've got to go find some YouTubers go, well, this is how I've interpreted this one. And I think the most recent example, Aeon Trespass did that. You know, Aeon Trespass has all these spaces in the box, and you've got all these spaces for cards and all these spaces for bits, but there's no guidance at all as to, and Aeon Trespass has like 10.7 million cards. And yeah, you could, it doesn't work though to go, well, I'm going to put Cycle 1 in this spot, Cycle 2 in this spot, Cycle 3 in this spot. It's like, nope, that doesn't work. Well, I'm going to put all the inventory cards in this spot and all the reactionary cards for the battles. Nope, it doesn't fit. And then they give you this tuck box that you can use to save your game, store your game in. And they go, well, here's 27 dividers. Do it however you like. I'm like, whoa, dude, you spent $7 trillion developing the game. Give me a clue, right? Like, I've got this tuck box and we've just ended up chucking all the terrain tiles in it. And I've gone and bought a third-party card box from Amazon to store everything in. And to be honest, that's working great once I've sort of come up with my own system on where to store the cards and how to put them in there. But, like, come on, man. You've charged me a lot. Interest was a lot. You've charged me a lot, and you put a bunch of plastic in here, and the minis are all in the right spot, but then I've got 9 trillion cards. Give me a hint. And I watch 2 or 3 videos, and people are, well, this is how I'm storing it, and it works, but nah. Anyway, first world problems. So, inserts. If you like inserts, you are spoiled for choice. Now, you've got different tiers of inserts. And this might be really boring for you. You might go, oh, Hammers, I'm out. Inserts, I'm not interested, I'm out. But I love an insert. Let me just not bury the lead here. I love an insert. I actually have inserts for games I've never played yet. I've got games on my shelf of firsts with inserts in them. Largely because one of the insert companies I love is called Folded Space. Now, Folded Space does foam core inserts. They come in sheets. You got to pop them out and assemble them. I can get a folded space insert for about $15. And to be honest, the night of assembling the folded space insert is as relaxing as playing a board game for me. I love it, particularly when they're really complicated or there's a lot of different boxes. You know, like the Gaia Project folded space insert, it wasn't $15, that was more expensive, but it had like 32 boxes that you've got to put together and then sort out. But then when it's all done, the game all slips in there. Now, Super Trooper, he freaking loves baggies, man. He loves baggies. Every game he owns, it's put it in bags, stick it in the box. It does my head in. Not, it's his game. Like, I don't care. But for me, I think part of it comes from, you know, being a chef, everything I store and put away professionally, you know, since I was basically 15 years old, has been meticulously organized, meticulously labeled. There's no OCD involved. It just makes me happy to go into a cool room or a pantry or a dry store or whatever the case is and see, well, this is how it's sorted. And so when I slide the top off a box, you know, for Revive, for example, and everything is exactly where it needs to be, I love it. Whereas when I open my box of Dune Imperium, that's 35 little bags. And the first 9 minutes is, well, first we've got to sort the bags and sort the parts and make little piles on the table. You know, and that, I get, has zen in and of itself. You know, I love setting up for a game day. We're doing Voidfall. It's an hour to set up Voidfall. Maybe not 40 minutes. I love it. It's got an insert. It still takes me 40 minutes to set up because you've got to pull it all out. You've got to put it all together. I love it. And if setting up games from baggies is your thing, I'm not here to yuck your yum. You fill your boots. I love pulling little things, little boxes out, and they're all ready to go. It makes me so happy. Just as happy as filing it all away again. It all goes in that little insert, and it all goes back in. So I'm a folded space junkie, right? So games I've got, I can look at my shelf of firsts, and I've got Food Chain Magnate on there, which is probably... Food Chain Magnate doesn't have a lot of complex parts. You know, it's a gazillion tokens, it's a gazillion cards. The folded space insert, I think I got it on sale for $11. It's in there. Never played folded Food Chain Magnate. Teletum is also on my shelf of firsts. Teletum has a bazillion bits. I took the opportunity. Same thing. Folded space insert. Ooh, $17-18. It's a night of entertainment for me. I sit down at the bunker. I pop it all out. I glue it all together. I check all the seams. You get it all done. You stand back. Ooh, you wait till the next day, and then you put everything away. I love it. But folded space is your entry-level stuff. Folded space is function. Now, folded space a couple of years ago moved into both licensed and full-color inserts, which I also love. So, for example, Tapestry. Tapestry has 10 zillion parts, and half of it is full-color building minis. And so folded space brought out they actually have two versions of the Tapestry insert, depending on how many expansions you have. I don't know how they did it, but they've managed to create an insert. I had the Tapestry insert, I had Tapestry, and then Stonemaier went, hey, here's another expansion, here's 27 new civilizations, and blah, blah, blah. And Fold of Space went, challenge accepted, and they created a version 2 insert that basically reconfigured the inside of the box, and everything for Tapestry goes in the original Tapestry box. I have no idea how they do it. I love it. And it's full color, and there's pictures of the buildings and everything, so you know which building goes in where. It's amazing. That's folded space. Now, sometimes for some of us, that's not enough, right? Let's talk about my buddy Coop. Now, Coop loves games. Coop loves co-op games. That's one of his favorite things, but he also loves campaign games. Now, Coop is a LaserOx fangirl, right? So something like Frosthaven, which Coop has everything for, he also has the Frosthaven LaserOx. It's not even an insert. It's an outsert, right? It's a crate. And that crate, you need an engineering degree to put it back together at the end of the game. But it is like the TARDIS when you start unpicking it. You pull the top off that crate and it's like, woo. And everything has a little box and everything has a spot and everything's got an icon on it. And it is gorgeous. I don't know how much the LaserOx crate is. It's a lot. I don't even care. Coop is single. Well, I don't know. He might have a girlfriend. I don't know, Coop. You know, I don't know. If he does, I haven't met her, and good on him. But he doesn't have any kids. So, and Coop is a successful middle-aged man like the rest of us. And so his disposable, if he can afford the LaserOx, that's amazing. Because also when you play Frosthaven with Coop, he also goes, well, here's your individual magnetized Laserarc player dashboard, which is a freaking delight. You put this monstrosity in front of you, and it's got spot for all your item cards and spot for all your tokens and a spot to slide in your player dashboard. And you sit there in front of your little player dashboard, and it is magnificent in every possible way. I absolutely love it. Love, 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 love it. I love playing Frosthaven, not because Frosthaven's great, but because the experience is enhanced by all of this accoutrement that you just get to sit surrounded by. And it is an experience. It's a day of just being immersed in this amazingness sort of stuff. And then you got stuff in between, you know, you got stuff that's, I have two wooden inserts. I'm lucky enough to have two. I have one that was gifted to me. I have the Broken Token wooden insert for Terraforming Mars that was gifted to me at the very start of all this by Super Trooper, and it's beautiful. And it, again, you know, I don't invest in that sort of stuff often because it's got to be a game that I either A, absolutely bazonkers adore, or B, I've got to get it at a bit of a deal. But I do have, there's a company called Smonex, S-M-O-N-E-X, which is a small business in Europe. And they do probably what I would call the prettiest inserts. And there again, it's laser cut balsa wood, but they also do etched plexiglass / perspex lids for everything. And I have that for Spirit Island. And it is so beautiful. All the player pieces there in their own little box with their own click-on lid and all of the Dahan and all it. It is beautiful. And yeah, it cost a bomb, but it is absolutely gorgeous. And why? Because I wanted it. Like, I think when you get to that point of an insert, guys, we're not talking about functionality. Yes, it functions, but you're talking about enhancing games that you adore. You know, and again, I think I've got the folded space for Underwater Cities. Underwater Cities is on my shelf at first. I love the look of it. I love the feel of it. I love the way. I've even gone out and bought deluxe resources for Underwater Cities because I could get them on Etsy and they were cheap and they're gorgeous. It's on my shelf at first. I've not played it. That's bonkers, right? Like, I've invested in deluxe resources and an insert for a game I've never played. I mean, let's be honest. That's mental, isn't it? I think it's mental. I think it's mental. And I'm perfectly happy. But that said, inserts. We buy inserts because we need them. We buy inserts because we want them. Or we buy inserts because the one that came with the game is so shithouse you don't have a choice. I'm looking at you, Teotihuacan Big Box. I don't own it, but I'm just suffering the repercussions and the PTSD of somebody who does. That's all. Just a little bit of psychobabble. A little bit of a dump on how much I love inserts. Why I love inserts. Why I think everyone should love inserts. Inserts. And this week's clap, we're going to give someone the clap, of course. This is one man clapping, so I'm going to clap for somebody. It goes to Matthew Mundy. Matthew Mundy, I mentioned earlier, he is the designer of Flock Together. Now, I'm giving him the clap not just because he created a really cool game. It is a really cool game. And it's a co-op game that has a look and feel that is different to most of the co-op games I've played. It's got stunning art, but also because he's so active on social media and clearly absolutely loves what he does. A gentleman of the sport, and I look very much forward to interacting with his future content. Matthew Mundy, well done, man. I absolutely love the game. It hasn't sat on my shelf at first for very long, but we are going to play the daylights out of it. Here's to you. And that concludes this week's self-induced verbal lobotomy. I feel lighter for dumping my week on all of you. It's your problem now. You can reach me on all the socials. Find me on Facebook by searching One Man Clapping. Email wonmanclapping@gmail.com. You can Instagram me at the number One Man Clapping. And you can help One Man Clapping by dropping me a like on Facebook or Instagram. Or leaving a review on whatever platform you choose. If it's a bad review, I work in hospitality. Don't worry, I can take it. Our next guest is locked in for February for Not All Heroes Wear Capes. I won't announce just yet who it is, but it's very exciting. They are contributors. I want to use the word influencers. They are contributors. They are influencers. They do influence, but I think they'd be offended to be labeled as such. And I look very much forward to having a conversation with them in February and sharing that conversation with you. Thank you, as always, for your time. This week's episode has been brought to you by the crushing weight of not living in a simulation. Every day it's, can I eat that without dying? Seriously, everything is going to kill you. Everything. Can I eat that? Until next time, get your game on, even if you've got to play with yourself. And remember, board games are friends too. Peace out, mofos. Too Many Bones Trove Chest is not an insert, it's an outsert. It fills a whole Calax and it keeps everything sorted. So good.